In 2006, Tanara Burke, a Black American woman, had used the hashtag MeToo on MySpace to build a movement of solidarity for victims of sexual violence. But it was 2017 when actress Alyssa Milano tweeted on the website formerly known as Twitter, quote, "If you've been sexually harassed or assaulted, write me too in reply to this tweet," end of quote. This is when the movement swept across the globe, going viral almost worldwide. The Me Too movement did so in part because it was able to be molded to fit different contexts and needs of survivors around the globe. But not always. Not everywhere. Fears of white feminism and Western influence followed this movement as it spread, causing tension that could not always be resolved. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Cyborg Goddess, a feminist tech podcast. That's right, we have rebranded for season 3. But like always, this podcast is part of the Harbinger Media Network. I'm your host, Jennifer Jill Fellows, and today I've invited Dr. Ikra Chima to talk to me about the Me Too movement and transnational feminism. Dr. Ikra Chima is an assistant professor in the Humanities Department at Graceland University. She is a scholar and teacher of contemporary literature and cultural studies of the global majority. Her research and teaching interests focus on 20th and 21st century literature and film, digital cultures, and transnational digital feminism. Hi, Ikra. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Jill.
This is fun because last time that we were recording a podcast, you were interviewing me and now I get to interview you, which is super exciting. And I get to ask you all these questions about this awesome book that you edited called The Other Me Toos, which is about Me Too movements around the globe. And I'm super excited to get into it.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very excited to talk about it.
So I'm going to pause for a moment and recognize that digital space is physical space. The internet is built and sustained with physical infrastructure and the servers and cables that connect us today and that allowed the Me Too movement to spread globally do occupy physical space. Digital space is created through resource extraction and maintained through energy consumption and human labor. And so I want to recognize that Cyborg Goddess, the feminist tech podcast, is recorded today on the unceded territory of the Coast Salish people of the Kakait Nation. Okay, so I want to begin with some background. How was it that you became interested in literature and film studies? Can you tell me like your academic journey?
Yeah, of course. I had always been interested in literature. Like I grew up reading, I was a bookworm. So I was reading a range of topics, like, you know, that went from children's magazine to like books on Islamic exegesis to novels to travelogues, everything, even things that I wasn't really interested in, but I wanted to know about them just so I could claim that I knew them. So I was doing a lot of that. And I think gender was just kind of like an constant part of all of those conversations because it just has that kind of like omnipresence around us. And then the conversations that happen around you, in your family, in your community, when you interact with people, like it's like mostly women or like men, they're always talking about, you know, like the expectations, the roles, like what they're supposed to do and all of those things. So I was always kind of like thinking about those things. So I kind of like got introduced to gender and sexuality studies and all of that in an informal way at a very early age. But then I kind of like started engaging with that more intentionally or more academically or critically in grad school. I came to film like a little late because I come from a very traditional family, so film was considered a bad influence.
Oh, wow.
Like, we had to devise this like whole plan, like basically even to like, you know, like watch one film so we could like carve this space and like time when like nobody was home and like nobody could like see us watching films and all of that. So I really kind of like started watching films when I was actually doing my master's. And I had like my own laptop and all that because then I could be doing like whatever, you know. So I think that way I could say that I came to literature first and then like gender studies and then film.
So it was like clandestine film watching
Yeah.
before grad school. Interesting. And yeah, I take your point about like gender being kind of everywhere and from a very early age. Like I have a kid who's picking up on this stuff so early about like, well, this is the roles for girls in the culture that she's in, and this is the roles for boys. And I'm like, whoa, where did this stuff come from? It happens so quickly, and
Yeah.
kids are so interested in it.
Right, exactly. And maybe, you know, at that age, like when I was a kid at that time, I wasn't really exactly thinking about, like, you know, is it a good thing or a bad thing or all of that, right? I was just more thinking in terms of, like, oh, do I want to do this thing or do I not want to do this thing, right? So then, like, there were some instances where I was like, oh my God, like, I never want to do this thing and I want to be this person or never want to be in this position, right? So I think
Yeah.
we kind of like get that kind of like political entry.
Yeah, the more critical political maybe comes later.
Right, exactly. But then, like, yeah, the ability to critically think about that comes a little later.
Yeah, which is challenging because that means that in some respect, you've already kind of internalized a lot of norms before you
Right.
start thinking about them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you are the editor of this awesome book, The Other Me Twos, published in 2023, and I will have a link in the show notes if people want to check it out. Can you tell me a little bit about what motivated you to take on this project?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, we all saw the Me Too movement unfold in 2017. I was very interested in it. I kept a keen eye on everything that was happening around it, things that people were writing about the movement, right? The comments that people were making on the movement. But one of the things that I noticed was that it gained more attention, or kind of like people looked at the Me Too movement outside of the West or outside of the United States, only on more like specific days. For example, like there are essays on Women's Day, right? But then there are like constantly conversations that are happening about the Me Too movement in the West on other days. But people weren't really thinking or critically like commenting on like what is it that the movement is doing internationally about the transnational impact of the movement, right? Or even the influence of the conversations that happened in the American context on the international feminist politics in that instance, right? And it felt paradoxical also because it's not that people stop committing violence when it's Women's Day or like the days beyond that or any of those things. So I was kind of like looking for this kind of commentary. I remember specifically this one photo essay that I read in Washington Post, which had a bunch of images from Iran, France, India, Pakistan, right? So it was just a collage of different photos from women's marches in all of these countries. And that image kind of just stayed with me because I was looking at all of these photos. And even if we think about women's choice to cover their heads or not cover their heads, cover their hair or not cover their hair, then too, for all of these images, for all of these women to find place in this one article was very interesting to me, which I associated with the Me Too movement itself in that way, right? Because all of these people were able to look at it or come at it from their own different positions. So that's also what kind of like got me interested into that. Like I was consistently thinking about that image when I was thinking about the ways in which people were engaging with the Me Too movement. And when I was looking at the different scholarly or academic engagements with the Me Too movement, there were some really interesting books that I read. So for example, there was Me Too and the Politics of Social Change that was edited by Bianca Feilborn and Rachel Loney House, and the Global Me Too Movement by Anne Noel and David Oppenheimer that focused on the field of law. So I read both of these books. Then there were other books that came during the process of me putting together the Me Too, the other Me Toos, which was like reporting on sexual violence in the Me Too era. which was edited by Andrea Baker and Usha Rodriguez, etc. And all of these books were wonderful. I learned a lot from all of these books, but all of these books also kind of like highlighted the importance of doing something more comprehensive about the Global South or the international impact of the Me Too movement beyond the West. So then, you know, following Toni Morrison's advice, like, you know, if there's a book that you want to read, but it hasn't been written yet, then you must write it.
I love it.
Like, okay, I'll get started on this project. So that's how the project came to be.
That's awesome. Yay. No, I think that's really interesting because I think it sounds like in the academic literature, we still had quite a focus on the United States context or the global West. But also, I think that that's often the picture that was put out by a lot of mainstream media as well, that a lot of
Right.
it focused on, yeah. on and particular voices, which we'll get to, but particular voices in the global West as well. And so I really appreciate this volume for amplifying other perspectives and other voices that I don't think the mainstream Me Too discourse, at least as I understood it, necessarily highlighted. So
right,
thank you for
exactly.
taking on that challenge of writing the book you wanted to read. So
yeah.
I think we've already kind of hinted at this, but the book is really expansive. It covers what the Me Too movement looked like in a number of different locations and cultures globally. There are chapters on Indigenous communities' interactions with Me Too, on the shape the movement took in Morocco, in Pakistan, India, South Korea, Egypt, and the Czech Republic, to name just a few. And this podcast episode will not be able to do justice to the breadth of material covered. So please, listeners, go find the book. But I do want to talk about some of the themes I noticed and about maybe some individual chapters. Before we jump into all of that, though, this is a work of transnational feminism, as you already kind of mentioned. So obviously, transnational feminism is a huge discourse, but can you tell us a little bit about what this is as kind of an entry point or what transnational feminism seeks to do or examine, particularly for listeners who might not be familiar with this concept?
So to answer this, I will go back to kind of the evolution of the term itself, where I'll try to define transnational feminism and its goals against and in comparison with other internationalist feminist movements. So the term itself kind of like goes back to initial contentions between white feminism and feminisms of color, both in feminist theory and practice, which then took us to global feminism and international feminism to be more inclusive, to involve all these people from all these other countries around the globe. But global feminism advocated for transcending national borders, which is a thorny subject, but at the same time, like, you can't just completely let go of that when you're talking about feminist politics, especially when we are thinking in the context of imperial and colonial global histories. Whereas international feminism presupposed nation states as discrete and sovereign entities, which is also a very thorny position to take, as Karen Kaplan and Indipal Grewal explain in their own work. So both global and international feminism received criticism for their rather reductive approach to not only issues of racism and imperialism, but also for mischaracterizing women's lives as monolithic and universal and as a singular phenomenon, right? Much of which we see in Audre Lorde's work, in Chandra Mohanty's work, in Hazel Harvey's work laid out, right? So that was a concern that remains very dominant in the conversations that all women of color, like Black feminists, are writing about, talking about. So responding to that, then third world feminists proposed historicizing the third world women's oppression in their locations to examine their agency and diverse forms of their activism, as we see in Chandra Mohanty's and Kumari Jayawardena's work in the 90s. However, then transnational feminism replaced third world feminism and became a more familiar, more known, more widely accepted term, much of which kind of like is laid out in Amanda Swar and Richa Nagar's work, Critical Transnational Feminist Practice, where they talk about the evolution of the term in that way. Overall, I think transnational feminism challenges the assumption of women's homogeneity or the conception of global sisterhood. It examines gendered epistemic privilege, intersectionality, deleterious effects of global capitalism, and politics of international feminist solidarity. And in doing so, it aspires to historicize and situate and examine the gendered relations and their formation in global racial, colonial, and imperial contexts.
That's really helpful. So if we're looking at global feminism there might be a tendency to try and think of women as having kind of a woman's experience in common or something like that, which is obviously threatening of reductivism and ignores right. kind of historical and contemporary contexts. And if we're looking right. at international feminism, we're presupposing nation states, which obviously many of which came into being through colonial forces and conflict and things like that. And this might also right. erase or neglect certain ethnicities and other cultural contexts. So transnational right. feminism, if I'm understanding, just as an entry point, seeks to acknowledge the histories that have shaped particular women's lives in particular cultural contexts and social locations. And that might include national politics and things like that, but it might include other things as well, other kind of cultural, social, perhaps religious influences as well. Does that sound fair?
Yes.
Amazing. Thank you so much for that entry point. Okay, so we've got kind of our conceptual tool of transnational feminism here on the table. But for any listeners not familiar already, can you tell us a bit about the origins of the Me Too movement and how the movement became a viral online feminist phenomenon?
Right, yes, exactly. I think most of the listeners probably are aware with the Me Too movement as it started in 2017 with Alyssa Milano's tweet. But after Milano tweeted that, then a lot of the people like learned that this was not a new movement. This was actually a movement that Tarana Burke had started in 2006 on MySpace with the same name. So Milano's tweet made the movement international in part because of the following that she has there, in part because Twitter works in a very different way than MySpace did, right? And a lot more people have access to that. But when Milano learned of Burke's Me Too movement, she acknowledged her contribution, and then Burke accepted her role as the leader of the Me Too movement in that instance. But that is also the space where the question of the politics of solidarity comes into play, because Milano's tweet received responses from celebrities like Lady Gaga or Jennifer Lawrence. And Burke only started to get credit for her work after Black feminists and other allies started amplifying her work and started advocating for her and started highlighting all the work that she had already done to start the Me Too movement since 2006 and had not been able to receive as much attention as Milano had done, right? So we can think about all these different sociopolitical shifts, like broader cultural acceptance of feminist politics, increased international recognition or the need for feminist justice, awareness about intersectional feminism, availability of feminist vocabularies that happened during the time period between 2006 to 2017. But at the same time, I think we can also think about the politics of white feminism at play in these instances as well, right? Burke, in one of her interviews, also commented that discrediting her work was perhaps unintentional, but somehow sisters of color managed to get diminished or erased in these situations. And Burke's Me Too remains international because in its origination, even it imagines an international sisterhood of Black, Indigenous, and people of color survivors under the assumption that all of these survivors are equal and they are equally deserving of justice, which is something that gets erased or not addressed when it comes to white feminisms a lot of times. But despite all of these, Me Too continues to be a massively successful feminist movement of our times, I believe. Like since 2017, when it was started, like between October to November, the hashtags Me Too and Women's March had been tweeted more than 2.3 million and 11.5 million times, Whoa. Respectively, in multiple indigenous and national languages worldwide, right? And it is the grassroots appeal of the movement that made it successful. It is like every daily common people's participation in the movement that made it into what it is. But women of color generally are on their own in times of crisis, like we see feminist response and feminist engagement with Palestine right now, even in some instances, right? So I think like these remain some very thorny questions around the Me Too movement itself. But despite all of these challenges, it has been very formative and very impactful internationally.
And I think that points to a tension that we're going to draw out more throughout this conversation. I do think that a lot of people, myself included, did not know the Me Too movement until 2017. I didn't know about it. I later, as many people did later, subsequently found out about Tanara Burke in 2006. And part of that might have been because I was never on MySpace, but part of it is probably also because of my social location as a white feminist living in Canada,
Right.
which definitely shapes what I regularly have access to and see and what I don't see. And so I think that that's a really important conversation to have and to think about the way in which technologies work. So you mentioned Twitter as being a place that functions differently than MySpace, but also whose voices are being amplified on which platforms is
Right.
really important as well.
Right, exactly. And when we talk about, especially when we talk about like feminisms and transnational feminism, then the question of whose voices are getting amplified, whose voices are silenced, or like are blocked or kind of restricted in all these different ways that we witness every day, becomes a difficult question, especially if you have to engage with the questions of like technology and the impact of social media in these contexts. But I think overall, for at least for the Me Too movement, Me Too became then the integrative site where both Burke and Milano could come together because they had like one shared goal. This is generally accepted.
So now that we have the background a little bit, I want to take a moment and examine your own first interactions with the Me Too movement, which you talk about in the preface to this collection of essays. So it sounds like similarly to me, you first encountered this movement in 2017. And in the collection of essays, you write about encountering the hashtag MeToo trending on social media. Can you talk a little bit about that encounter and about why the decision over whether to participate in this movement was challenging for you?
Yeah, definitely. I think there are two sides to that question. Like, first is personal, then there is like the communal side to it. So, me, just like as a person, I am more of an introvert generally. So, like, that's, like, first reason because I'm like, oh my God, like, should I put this like personal thing online,
Right.
social media for other people to see? Like, I'm just kind of like scared of people like looking into my life in that way. But that's the
I
minor.
can relate to that.
Right, exactly. So, but that's like a minor thing in that context. I think like the major concern for me was that how does our participation gets interpreted in these situations, right? And I will use the current conversations and the way media is engaging with like the things that are happening in Palestine right now, right? A lot of times, and okay, like this is clearly a feminist issue. But it's not perceived as a feminist issue, right? All the violence that is being committed against Palestinian men, against Gazans right now, does not count as violence. And we have seen like some of this reportage from Israeli media where they're like, oh, these men are naked because it's like hot in Gaza. And like, that's why they're not wearing any clothes and all that. So a lot of these stereotypes that prevail in the West about brown men and brown women and black men. Now we see that they still are very much part of the psyche of like white feminist psyche in so many ways. And that was one of the major questions that I had to think about when I was deciding whether or not to participate in the movement itself. Because if I say, like, I have spent most of my life in Pakistan. I grew up there and then like I sit somewhere and I'm like, okay, like I have experienced these and these things, then automatically it like proves a lot of those stereotypes true in an instance, because of course nobody's like really kind of like critically engaging with like the politics of this kind of violence, right? And I don't, especially on social media, like we don't have the space to engage with that in those critical terms where we can like acknowledge all of the different challenges that come with this kind of like experiences, right? So that was my major concern that in doing so, am I further vilifying my own communities in that
Right.
way? But also at the same time, like if people don't have enough information to read into these experiences, then what kind of politics does it constitute? Because if we are talking about the reductiveness in so many of the engagements that happen around sexual violence, gendered violence, then if people don't have all the information that helps them form a more nuanced position on a subject, then what kind of politics does it constitute? Does it strengthen? Does it make more valid? So those are some of the issues that I was thinking about when I was a little perplexed about my own participation in the Me Too movement.
So, to put this in a bit of context, I have to tell the listeners that I record these episodes well in advance. And at the time of recording, we are about 2 to 3 months past the October 7th Hamas hostage taking and the Israeli government's response that has led to the displacement, harm, and death of many, many Palestinian men, women, and even more sadly, children. I also wanted to say, though, that it sounds like one of the conflicts that you had regarding whether or not to participate in this movement is because of colonialism and white feminism's complicitness in othering racialized men, whether it's Palestinian men, whether it's Pakistani men, and perhaps the concern, it sounds like, if that's fair, that participating in a Me Too movement as a woman who grew up in Pakistan would be seen as contributing to the othering of racialized men. Is that part of what the concern was?
Right, yeah. So I think a lot of times, like Western discourse specifically relies on these binaries when we have to like have these conversations about global politics, right? Or imperial colonial histories of violence. So that kind of like binary that remains very prevalent of like men against women or like women against men in that instance that fails to account for all the different ways in which we have some like shared goals or shared aspirations, or we have shared experiences of like the same kind of violence, right? Whether we call it like imperial or whether we call it gendered or whether, you know, it is sexual or whether it is all of those things at the same time. So I think it's like mostly that kind of binaristic approach to these conversations that sometimes can be a little uncomfortable if we don't have the space to talk about that in detail.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. This also reminds me a little bit of some of Crenshaw's discussions regarding intersectionality, right? That there are decisions that white women don't necessarily understand or are concerned about trying to make regards to racialized women and thinking about kind of this the confluence of racism and sexism and how that can make unique experiences that white feminism often fails to acknowledge the nuance of. Okay. So there's a theme that appears in a number of chapters that we've already talked about a little bit. And the theme that appears in a number of chapters in this text is that the Me Too movement is perceived as a white and Western brand of feminism. So this kind of leads quite naturally off of what we were just talking about. And that the Me Too movement is also often seen as a way of extending colonial or Western power or influence, particularly once we start talking about different contexts. This makes the movement often becomes perceived as dangerous, and also people who join the movement or support it globally may also be seen as dangerous. Can you talk about how this manifests a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, this kind of like discomfiture with the term feminism in general also like has this like very long global history, especially in the post-colonial world and in North America in that instance, right? Where we're constantly like trying to then think of all the ways in which we can engage with feminism without giving into like the white feminist tendencies in so many different ways, right? Because a lot of times, if you think in that context, feminism basically equates imperial feminism and it kind of like weaponized in the service of these goals, right? Rafia Zakaria's book Northern Disruption does a wonderful job of explaining this discomfiture and like why people generally are resentful about feminism and like consider it more of a Western influence or Western propaganda in that instance. So that's one major thing I think that kind of like recurs again and again when we have these conversations, just this kind of like colonial and imperial baggage that the term feminism itself carries in its own, right? Along with that, I think white feminism, as soon as it kind of like touches borders with international feminism, especially feminisms in the global South and the global majority communities, it tends to become very apolitical. or its whiteness that could also be read as imperial, colonial, or capitalistic aspirations takes over very immediately. And a lot of times, feminists are not even aware of that or that tendency in their own work in a lot of ways, right? So we can also look back at the racist stereotypes about like non-white bodies, most of which we see now and most of which we see that remain very much intact in the white feminist psyche to a large extent, right? Especially if we look at the different kinds of violence that is unfolding all around the world right now in Africa, in Middle East, right? In Asia. So like those are some of the things which then kind of like give us a logical explanation, a rationale for the discomfiture that people generally feel when they have to engage with the term feminism or anything that originates from the West, especially anything that originates from American grounds, for that instance, right? But along with that, I think one good thing about Me Too has been that people have been able to modify the term, adapt the term, translate the term in different ways. So it could be indigenized, it could be localized, and it could still like sustain some of its transnational character in that instance. So in that way, it has offered an inclusive model of solidarity via a hashtag, which is instantly accessible and available, and in some instances is a lot more safer than on ground political work can be in a lot of places. And other thing that I can think of and that I discuss in my book is also the different goals of feminisms that we engage with, right? So for example, even if you think of the public space in feminist conversations, I think the goal in terms of like visibility and access to public space like looks very different in the global West and in the global South in that instance. So for example, achieving visibility in public spaces has been a goal for women in South Asia for a long time, right? We have seen initiatives like Girl-led Dhabas in Pakistan and Why Loiter in India, which basically are about women's ability and then like being them being able to safely like go and, you know, like drink tea at a roadside hotel or like sit outside in public and feel safe, right? But this kind of like visibility kind of becomes depoliticized when it comes to the West because the goals for that are very, very different here, right? So in global West, then it kind of like becomes the economy of visibility, where it's associated with like the neoliberal capitalistic aspirations and market. But in the global South, in a lot of the countries, I think it is still a politics of visibility where it is very deeply entrenched with the feminist politics itself beyond any other kind of goals that may be attached with that. So those are just some of the things that make our engagement with feminism a little bit more of a reluctant interaction, I think.
I think that makes sense. But I think there's something kind of hopeful in what you said there as well, which is this idea that the Me Too movement specifically is malleable, flexible, is able to change shape and serve people's interests and needs in different contexts, in a way in which perhaps just kind of feminism in general has been a little bit like feminism coming from particularly the United States has been a little bit harder to engage with in ways that recognize the context and lived experiences of South Asian women, for example, or of women in other parts of the globe.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think you are right in saying that. And I think like that's one good thing about like this kind of reductiveness that is generally associated with a lot of these concepts, especially when we talk about the Me Too movement, because it is reductive in the sense because it is like, okay, we are all like gathered on this one issue of gendered violence, sexual violence, right? But then there is like room, there is a place, it is like malleable enough that we can add more information onto that so that it is nuanced for the context in which it is being used, it is being mobilized as a political tool.
Right. So kind of the reductive or like flat nature of the Me Too message allows it to honor the kind of different or to reflect different contextual issues of gendered violence or of harassment
Right,
in different
exactly.
contexts.
Yeah. And that can happen like without everybody's or, like a lot of people's participation in it, because
Yeah.
if there's that participation doesn't exist, then it is just that. It is like a very reductive, meaningless movement. So it becomes meaningful because of all this place that other people can make for themselves in the movement, right?
I think that's so cool.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because as you said, there's a lot of advantages that people have found in this global Me Too movement. And throughout the book, there are many articles that detail a given community's participation in the Me Too movement as a way to amplify voices, connect them to this kind of global sisterhood or solidarity, but also raising awareness of particular issues in particular contexts. So, can we talk a little bit about some of this, about the advantages that some people found or some communities found?
Yeah, definitely. Yes, thanks for the question. I was lucky enough to receive like so many interesting, amazing, wonderful essays for this collection, and a lot of these essays were great teaching tools for myself in that instance too, right? So some of the essays that we discuss in the book, or that like we read in the book, they kind of like highlight these communal movements that emerge from this more transnational movement. So, for example, Mosque Me Too, the chapters that I have in the book, they discuss that in the context of Pakistan, but then it kind of like becomes a place where all of these women from different Muslim countries, they can share an experience, right? They can share the experience of sexual violence, of gendered violence that they experience while they are performing Hajj, right? The pilgrimage to the Holy Land for themselves in that situation. So in that instance, like it then becomes a model, or it becomes a place for another kind of movement that goes beyond national borders, right? That goes beyond even culture in this instance, and that is solely based on this like religious practice, which in itself looks very different for different people because religion and culture are like generally so intertwined with each other. So in that way, I think like it becomes a really amazing model of like intersectional feminism in that instance too. Some other chapters that I also received, like one chapter is contributed by Zoe Eddy about indigenous feminisms. There is one more chapter about the Me Too movement in Morocco and Tunisia, right? So to give the reader a better understanding of what Zoe talks about in her chapter, I'm just going to read two paragraphs from her introduction.
This is the chapter about Indigenous feminisms and the Me Too movement.
Right, yes.
Awesome.
So this chapter is titled Dear Women Dancing. So in the introduction, then Zoe writes, when Me Too swept the media, a frustrated sigh sounded across Turtle Island. This frustration echoed that of other activists. Tarana Burke started the movement for Black and Brown women and girls, and yet white women dominated the mainstream narratives. Indeed, Burke and others have criticized the campaigns. Current iterations for its focus on white survivors. To an Indigenous survivor among a community of Indigenous survivors, Me Too sometimes feels as though a bleeding wound has opened further. After all, Indigenous activists have long been seeking redress for the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. A conversation with a friend epitomized my own sentiments. Me Too isn't secret in Indian country, it's literally a statistic. If you are looking at me and I am native, then it's literally probable that you know me too. Nevertheless, the popularization of Burke's movement among white feminists and their adjacent circles has created a re-entry point for Indigenous survivors. As Abigail Eco Hawke stated in a 2018 interview, movements such as Me Too have opened up this conversation nationwide, and I believe created a more welcoming environment for stories like these. In North America, mainstream advocacy networks are literating the language of Me Too. Indigenous activists have seized on this moment to emphasize Indigenous approaches to ending sexual violence, right? So if we look at this, like this kind of like shows us then how Me Too has been used to mobilize this other kind of politics, right? Like it created this space for an Indigenous movement. It created space for more localized movements where then
Right.
or these movements, they kind of like contain their own character, their own politics, but are also able to like bring that politics onto a broader forum that needs to engage with those questions that Indigenous feminists are talking about, that Indigenous feminists are speaking about, right? Which this one is situated in American context, in North American context. But the other chapter that I was talking about, Mosque Me Too movement, that doesn't really need any engagement from the Western media, from Western academia in that instance, that doesn't need any engagement from Western political circles in that instance anyway, because then it goes into a completely different context where it is like Muslim women, whatever their definition of Islam might be, they are talking about their own experience, right? In the context of their own community and the people who are responsible for that, and people who are responsible for like redressing that, for addressing that, for resolving those conflicts are completely different people, right? It's like, okay, like that. So the government need to give people more protection, right? Like, do they need to change their policies in Hajj? How do we address those issues, right? So it kind of like expands in all these different ways, depending upon the people who are participating in that movement, which I think has been a wonderful thing, in raising awareness and kind of like bringing more visibility to the different kinds of gendered and sexual violence that people experience.
Yeah, I think those two examples are really helpful. So, when we think about Indigenous movements, and we have talked on this podcast about MMIWG2S before, or No More Stolen Sisters, or Red Dress Project. And when we think about those movements, they existed independently of the 2017 Me Too viral movement. And you can hear the frustration in the opening paragraphs of that chapter that the Me Too movement is going viral, and these other both online and offline activist movements have existed and haven't gone viral in the West. And that this was both a frustration, but also an opportunity. But then when you talk about Mosque Me Too, it is the Me Too movement again, but in a different context and responding to different issues. And so it takes a different shape, right? In the Mosque Me Too movement, it's not about getting Western media to respond the way Indigenous movements use the Me Too movement to kind of leverage visibility. It's about using the Me Too movement to build solidarity among Muslim women in this case. In I think a lot of the Mosque Me Too in those chapters is Northern Africa and the Middle East, largely, though I'm sure Mosque Me Too may appear in other Islamic countries or for other Islamic women as well. But it's about building solidarity in those situations and not necessarily trying to get Western media to respond or to be involved at all. And I think that's really interesting to talk about kind of the malleability of this movement, that it can take on different characteristics in different places.
Definitely. And I think it takes us back to the question that you were asking earlier about the ways in which people engage with feminism a lot of times, right? Where like white feminism or the conversations about white feminism, which Rafia Zakaria like does not associate with people's skin color. Like it's more about the kind of politics that you practice, right? Like that's white feminist politics. Just like to clarify that when I use that term, I'm using it to mean that and not like necessarily like that the white people practicing
Kind of
feminism.
like a white cultural feminism.
White cultural feminism. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, and I think like that's great because if we talk about the indigenous movements in that instance, it's critical for these movements to get engagement and attention from the Western media, right? Like from the mainstream media in that instance, which is not necessary when we talk about the Mosque Me Too movement because it's not directly in any way influenced by all of these factors, right? So that is helpful. Another chapter that I really love in the book is written by Nicolas Juarez called Native Men Too, Settler Sexual Violence, Native Genocide, and A Dream of Fire, where he talks about Native men's experience and like Native men saying Me Too, right? Which he says that it is not to undermine like women's claims and women's experiences, but just to kind of complicate and deepen the discourse on sexual violence and agency, specifically as they relate to gender and race, which is very critical to engage with, because a lot of times when people think of like gendered or sexual violence, the automatic victim that emerges in many people's minds is women, right? Which is not always the case. And violence against men remains so understudied, and it doesn't get the attention that it should receive in that instance, which is becoming more and more clear, I think. So I think that chapter is also very critical. And that is actually the only chapter written by a man that I have in this book. But I received that chapter and I wanted to make some room to talk about these other generally unimagined victims of violence too.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I know in my own context in Canada that men statistically are much more likely to be victims of sexual violence than to be falsely accused of being perpetrators of sexual violence. And yet the false accusation narrative, largely coming out of high-level US politics stuff, is definitely influencing the Canadian context such that a lot of people are more, seem to be more concerned about false accusations.
Oh
So I
my
do think
goodness.
we really do have an understudied area here when it comes to men as victims of sexual violence, for sure.
Definitely. Yeah.
So we've talked about the ways in which this movement, because of its malleability and its ability to adapt to local contexts, can be really, really helpful. But chapters in your book also looked at the ways in which sometimes the Me Too movement was not that helpful, depending on what was going on locally. So can we talk about regions where the Me Too movement just didn't seem to gain ground? So we know it's viral globally, but there were certainly local regions where it just didn't really take off.
Yes. So I have a bunch of chapters that talk about that. Some of the chapters talk about the Me Too movement and the kind of influence and impact it had it in Nepal. One chapter talks about it in Sri Lanka. Another chapter talks about the Me Too movement in Czech Republic, right? And as you said, depending upon the local context, depending upon like all the different ways in which feminism has been vilified or has been used or has found some kind of like root in these different like cultural and political context, it was used by feminists or and it was helpful and influential, but also in some instances it wasn't, right? So I think like one thing that we see happen again and again is what we were just discussing, like people's kind of like discomfort with the term feminism itself and its Western origins. And a lot of times, a lot of these agendas come from these organizations or come from these groups of people that live in the West. And they could be living in the West for like any number of reasons. It's not necessarily only white people, it can also be people in diaspora, immigrants, right? Any of those communities, but then the kind of trust and the kind of relationship that the local communities might have with all of these different people, influencers, with these organizations deeply affects how effective the Me Too movement could be in those instances, right? And sometimes I think even when the Me Too movement was successful in a lot of cultural context, or actually, I guess, like not the Me Too movement, but when feminism had gained like a ground and it had like a positive presence in these cultural contexts, then like Me Too also kind of like became a negative force in those instances too, because then those feminisms could be labeled Western propaganda or a Western influence because now Me Too was a part of the feminist movement in that instance, right? So it mostly was used like for a good reason, but I think at the same time, like there was this like potential for it to be used as a negative force in a lot of indigenous context because of the imperial baggage that it carries, because of like the white baggage that it carries, that basically is the part of its origination, part of the evolution of the movement itself, right? And along with that, I think it's NGOs a lot of times that like work in different communities also have a complex role in those situations. And I'm not an expert on NGOs, but Rafia Zakaria in her book has a really good chapter on that where she talks about how a lot of times NGOs fail to consider the local conditions and cultures and end up hurting the causes a lot more than actually benefiting. the local communities in many instances. And I think some of those factors then like contribute to demonizing feminists along with
Right.
the feminist goals.
So if I'm understanding correctly, there are definitely some contexts where there were, even online, hashtag feminist movements
Yeah.
that were gaining ground and making a difference, possibly changing public policy or gaining solidarity and sisterhood. And as Me Too swept around the globe, these movements sometimes were negatively affected by the perception that they were connected to Me Too, or perhaps people had tweeted Me Too along with the local hashtag. And this led to the suspicion that this was a kind of colonial imperialist force rather than a grassroots feminist movement.
Right.
This perception is not always helped out by certain contexts where NGOs might be pushing for specific Western white feminist type goals, for example, and therefore even further kind of tainting the idea of feminism. Or you mentioned the Czech Republic, and I was fascinated by this chapter where the Me Too movement was viewed often with suspicion as something akin to kind of communism, which the Czech Republic obviously has a history with. And so the Me Too movement was viewed with suspicion as something that was kind of a trial of public opinion, moving away from fair law and order and fair trials, and also viewed as communist influences. And so, in that way, the movement also gained suspicion and didn't gain ground, which could also hamper kind of feminist activist goals within the Czech Republic, for example. But this came up in a few different chapters, obviously in different contexts, in different ways. So, communism was unique to the Czech Republic context, but there were other contexts where, again, a local feminist movement might suffer or become undermined by a connection with Me Too. And I thought that that was really interesting.
Going back to even to the origin of the term transnational feminism itself and its evolution, I think that kind of like becomes interesting because there's a very complex relationship between the different states and heads of the states and the international character of a lot of political movements because of the way they have to respond to different kind of political crisis, whether it is a crisis based on gendered and sexual violence, whether it is a crisis based on like racial violence, whether it is a crisis that involves, all of these intersecting elements together. So that kind of like international pressure, international engagement, political engagement becomes necessary, but also is not always useful. And I think like that's the kind of complexity that we can't really kind of like, ever completely flatten or that we can't ever really reduce to like one thing or the other. And that's something that we will always have to like engage with and think about and like try to find like a balance between both of those things because this international engagement, it has the potential of like being a good thing and a bad thing at the same time.
Yeah. No, I think that's really interesting. So, for a lot of locations, the Me Too movement was helpful, but you can't not engage with it, and engaging with it is not always helpful. And that's what I think is, on the one hand, I want to call it the messiness, but on the other hand, it's like the rich complexity of transnational feminisms, right? It's messy and complicated, and you can't just reduce it to something simple. And that's kind of the point. Reducing is erasing, basically. So there's obviously this tension in the Me Too movement, which we just kind of talked about in terms of feeling like you have to engage in this kind of international viral movement, but also the flexibility of the movement that it might be helpful, but also the movement has definitely this kind of United States origins, and that carries with it certain dangers and risks and undermining perceptions, perhaps, of white feminism and colonialism and that kind of thing. And I wonder if some of the tension in the Me Too movement is in part a tension stemming directly from the way the movement went viral. You have this quote in the preface of this book that I just want to read out for our listeners because I can't really stop thinking about it. And so the quote you said, "Burke's Me Too supports an international sisterhood of BIPOC survivors under the assumption that all survivors are equal. But famous Me Too cases went viral after Milano's tweets suggest that some survivors are more equal than others. Can we talk a little bit about this tension between kind of finding international solidarity and amplifying voices versus the way the Me Too movement went viral, which is a prioritizing of very privileged white Western feminist voices, and how that might complicate the nature of Me Too in general?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, thinking about the Me Too movement sometimes, like I have wondered about the question of like, okay, when Alyssa Milano like tweets Me Too, who is she tweeting at, right?
Yeah.
Is she thinking about like every person who has experienced this? Is she thinking about majority of our followers, right? Is she just thinking like of the place where she's situated, where she lives, and then she's thinking in that context, right? And I don't have, of course, an answer to that question. That's just something that I think relates to this whole question of engagement with the Me Too movement and like, you know, some survivors being more equal than others in that instance, right? That holds very true because so many of the cases, not only in the United States, but outside of the US, too, have been the cases of people who hold these positions of privilege already. Like the movement could not be the movement that it is if just common people, like everyday people, people who are living their daily lives did not participate in it, right? But a lot of times then, like the critical conditions, the critical decisions that are taken about different issues that people face, about different positions or laws that are, you know, like they're shaped around the cases that basically don't really concern common people in a lot of instances. I think like you see one case and then, you know, it's like a celebrity, right? It's like a contestation between them and it may share like some of the things, some of the instances with every other person's experience. But then in the same way, this case remains very special because of like how powerful all the people who are in the case, involved in the case are in that instance. So any conversation that happens around that case then, how valid is that, or how relatable is that, or how constructive could that be if we are thinking in like culturally specific context, right? That's like one, I think, contestation that remains still today. And there is literally, I guess, like no way, once again, to just find a solution for that, you know, because so much of the culture that exists around us is basically culture of engagement at this point, right? And we can say that, okay, like these are the people that we are interested in, these are the people whose voices matter actually, right? But then who gets our attention and like who we pay attention to? So that kind of like economy of attention, I think, also is a deep part of the Me Too movement and the conversations that happen in that. And that's something that I don't really talk about in the book, but something that I constantly think of.
Yeah, and it is something that comes back to the movement going viral on social media,
right?
In particular, right?
Exactly.
And who are we all paying attention to on social media? And I don't want to say we all. Obviously, every individual makes their own choices.
Right.
But it is still true that like Alyssa Milano has a lot more followers than I think either you or I do.
Right, yeah.
But I really like the point you made. I thought it really resonated with kind of some of the things I was taking out of the book. This idea that the movement couldn't exist without all the average people who tweeted out their experiences or shared something under the hashtag, right? Like that's what kept the movement alive.
Right.
Exactly. And yet,
yeah,
it is also true in the United States that the movement went viral because of celebrities.
Right.
Tanara Burke's movement did not go viral. It wasn't till 2017.
Right.
And it is also a theme in a number of your chapters that the movement gains a boost in certain contexts, often because of high profile, powerful, privileged people in those contexts.
Right.
And so it's a way in which the movement is very flexible, but also risks silencing the very voices that are keeping it alive. Like if it's all of us who keep this going, and yet we're only paying attention to certain high profile individuals, there is this issue with the way the movement is moving around online, right? And where our attentions are being directed, which is
exactly
we could unpack issues of algorithms here and celebrity and intention economy, but it's shaping the movement.
Right, exactly. And I guess like part of it is just like the human desire to make heroes out of people too, right? So it's like certain celebrities presented as like feminist icons.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not really political, right?
No, I see that. So it's more about seeing individual heroes succeed.
Right.
Rather than necessarily changing the political conditions
right, exactly.
that lead to this structural violence.
Right.
The movement is still viral and still growing, and I hope it keeps spreading and keeps prompting more conversations. I want to thank Ikra for sharing her research on the global Me Too movement and transnational feminism with me today. And thank you, listener, for joining me for another episode of Cyborg Goddess. If you have a comment or a question about anything you heard today, please reach out on social media. You can reach out on the site formerly known as Twitter at @cyborg_goddess or on Blue Sky at cyborggoddess.bluesky.social. Both of those links are in the show notes. Or you can leave a comment directly on this podcast. Music is provided by Epidemic Sound. This podcast is created by me, Jennifer Jill Fellows. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider buying me a coffee. You can find a link to my Ko-fi page in the show notes. Until next time, everybody.